Let's have the Judiciary Committee come to order. It is 1:30 on the afternoon of February 17th, 2010. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Egan's here, Senator Wilkowski, myself, Senator French. Welcome to the committee, everyone. And today, the first matter is to take up the bill we held over from last time, Senate Bill 194. And you should have on your desks a proposed amendment to that bill. And the amendment, the effective amendment, is to make is to incorporate the changes to the penalties for those who are buying alcohol in violation of their sentences. Senator Wilkowski, your amendment.
I would move amendment number one.
And is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, amendment number one is adopted, although we'll give Senator Cockhill a minute to sit down and get caught up to speed and let him know what we're doing in case he does want to discuss it. It's the amendment we discussed last week, Senator, regarding bringing into the statute the penalties for those who are buying alcohol in violation of a court order. Senator Wilkowski.
And I'll just say, because I know Senator Cockhill had expressed some concern, my staff has met with staffer Senator Meyer, and my understanding is there's no objection there, and there doesn't seem to be any objection anywhere. It's a relatively minor amendment. There was some talk about the bill in the House, and this, quite frankly, does nothing close to what the bill in the House does. It just simply increases the penalty for people who are prohibited from buying alcohol to $1,500. And my understanding is there's support for the amendment.
Thank you, Senator Wilkowski. I'll just ask one more time if there's any objection to the amendment. Hearing and seeing none, the amendment is adopted. That brings the bill up before us. It's the third hearing, I believe, on the bill. committee discussion or a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we move CS for Senate Bill 194, version S, to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, the bill's moved. Thanks so much for your patience. Good committee work. We'll take a short at ease as we add the do the paperwork. We're back on the record. The Senate Judiciary Committee is back on the record, and we are here now to take up House Bill 186, the Firearms Freedom Act. We had an overview of the bill at a previous hearing, took public testimony, and today we're here to have a more in-depth discussion about some of the interesting legal issues that the bill raises. To that end, we have with us in the room, and I'll ask him to come forward, Jerry Luckupt from our alleged legal department. Mr. Luckup, welcome. We also have on the line Sue McClain from the Alaska Department of Law, and we have an individual from from Montana. We're getting his name right now, just so you all know. We will hear from Gary Marbot from the Montana Shooting Sports Association to get his view of the legalities, because it's an interesting area, and I wanted to have a full debate on that. So let's turn it over to Mr. Luckup. Welcome. You prepared a legal opinion about this matter last year in April, and I think you've done some work since then. Why don't you give us your overview of the issues raised by the bill and some of the research you've done on the topic. Thank you and welcome.
Mr. Chairman, thanks for being here. For the record, my name is Jerry Luckup, Legislative Counsel for the Division of Legal Services. The bill directly raises interstate commerce clause issues. And while it appeared for a while that the U.S. Supreme Court was going to exempt some wholly intrastate activities from the Commerce Clause, when the U.S. Supreme Court issued their decision in Raich versus Gonzalez, Gonzalez versus Raich in 2005, it seemed to put to rest those thoughts that there could be wholly intrastate activities that did not affect the Commerce Clause. The Raich case is significant because it dealt with medical marijuana. In California, the California legislature passed a law exempting medical marijuana activities and purporting to protect people who engage in medical marijuana activities in their intrastate commerce activities, their activities wholly within the state of California from any effect on interstate commerce, and the theory was that the federal government couldn't prosecute these folks. In an opinion by Justice Scalia, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected that view and said that even assuming that the activities were wholly intrastate and there wasn't any other effect, it would still affect interstate commerce. There was still an effect out there. What was significant was during the time that case was up on appeal, the Ninth Circuit, before that case was decided, the Ninth Circuit had a case involving a gentleman who manufactured machine guns wholly within the state of California and only sold them to people in the state of California. He had been prosecuted by the federal government for possessing a machine gun, and he was convicted, and the Ninth Circuit reversed his conviction before Raich was decided. The feds appealed that or sought cert in the U.S. Supreme Court. The Supreme Court sent the case back to the Ninth Circuit and told them to reevaluate their decision in the case based upon this Raich decision. And the Supreme Court, or the Ninth Circuit at that point, said, no, there are effects on interstate commerce. Even if this gentleman's activities were wholly intrastate, as claimed, it still affected interstate commerce, and the federal government would still have a right to regulate his activities. That's, I think, as close as we can get on point in a case like this. That said, you know, we've also, the legislature at times has passed laws that seem to be clearly unconstitutional or something, and medical marijuana was one, and it's still out there that medical marijuana, while we've exempted people from prosecution in the state courts, they still face prosecution in the federal courts, even though that issue has changed slightly with a recent opinion or a direction from the U.S. Attorney General to his U.S. attorneys and not seek prosecution. You know, we still have a law on the books, for that matter, the Tender Rebellion Statutes in 38 from this initiative that the people proposed in early 80s, that where we basically disclaimed the Statehood Act and said that all federal lands in Alaska belong to the state of Alaska. And we said we were going to start managing them and selling them and everything else. And those laws are still on the books in 38. So
I need to look those up. That's an interesting historical.
Right here, 3805-500 through 3805-505.
Thank you. Before Senator Wilikowski jumps in, let me just ask a question. Two things jump out at me regarding the cases you brought up. First, in Stewart, that's the machine gun case. I don't know, but I'll ask, had California passed anything similar to the law that we're contemplating, the Firearms Freedom Act?
Mr. Chairman, they did not.
And the other point I wanted to make, or just ask you if you think it's of any legal significance, there's no constitutional amendment giving you the right to use marijuana. On the other hand, you know, since the founding of the country, we've been pretty firm about your right to bear arms.
Right.
And does that, in your view, how do you weigh that sort of difference?
Well, you know, it's difficult to, you know, explain this, but Now, Justice Scalia in the Raich case didn't limit it to some...
He wasn't talking about marijuana.
You know, he didn't talk about whether or not you have a right to possess marijuana or try to equate it to the Second Amendment or anything. They're just looking at commerce. And the court said that even these intrastate activities still had an effect on interstate commerce, which means that the federal government and Congress have the right to intervene and do what they think is appropriate. My opinion doesn't really change considering the Second Amendment, because we've had cases for years that talk about whether or not it's involved, guns are involved in interstate commerce, and that's been one of the things that the court has, both the Supreme Court and other courts have looked at. And right now, the federal government only relates or regulates guns that are involved in interstate commerce. So for the most part, for some activities, there's others that are a little broader, but the normal possession activities and manufacturing things, those 18 U.S.C. 921, for the most part, relate to a firearm that's involved in interstate commerce. There's always a potential there is a firearm that's not involved in interstate commerce, but I think those intrastate commerce ideas took a real beating when this Raich case came out after a line of, well, actually, in my opinion, or my memo that I wrote, there were two cases in the last 20 years that seemed to say there was a limit on how far the Commerce Clause went with regards to interstate activities. And the Raich case kind of said everyone was confused when they were reading too much into these cases. So I'm not sure what else I can say there other than...
Let's turn to Senator Wilikowski. He may provoke more conversation.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm still sort of reeling from the idea that the Ninth Circuit said it was okay to manufacture machine guns and the U.S. Supreme Court reversed them. I guess it was probably the U.S. Supreme Court's just visceral knee-jerk reaction to reversing virtually everything the Ninth Circuit does. But my question is, if we pass this law, I've gotten a number of emails from people out there. I guess people just need to realize that there's still the potential that they could be prosecuted by the federal government. Is that correct? Although we do have a provision that the state must defend them.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that's the issue. If people would get the wrong impression from this that this is going to immunize them completely, I think they still likely have some criminal liability if they were engaged in this activity and the federal government decides to prosecute. It would be you would
actually just one point of order, just so folks who are listening or following along may not get the wrong impression. I think the issue of whether or not the Attorney General is going to defend them has been something that's we've gone back and forth on that from shall to may. And the current state of the bill, I think on page 3, line 18, is may. So there's no command that the Attorney General step in and defend someone who's charged in federal court with breaking federal firearms law. But please proceed.
Yeah. So it would be an unfortunate if someone decided to engage in the activity that's purported to be protected here, and then they were to find themselves subjected to criminal liability and a potential term in a federal prison. We did something similar with medical marijuana. We basically told people that we're exempting you from liability under the state law, but you still, I think there was a big effort to make sure people understood that there was this potential federal liability. And that's what the Raich case was about. This was a person who ended up being prosecuted in California. And, so as long as people understand what's going on, you're free to do what you would like here.
Senator Wilikowski.
And just so if that person, if a company sets up shop in Alaska, starts selling guns to people and advising them not to register, I mean, there's potentially a whole chain of prosecutions here for people selling the guns without, I guess, complying with federal regs, and for people buying the guns, for people not registering the guns. Is that, do you see that chain, sort of, or is this just the person who possesses the gun?
Well, I think the biggest issue will be the person manufacturing without obtaining that federal license or permit to engage in the gun manufacture. That's going to be the major problem. I'm not sure how, once it gets down the line, the person that that gun is sold to, how much liability they're going to face, just by accepting the gun from the other person. This case in California, they didn't prosecute the person that received the machine gun. In that case, they prosecuted the gentleman that was selling the machine gun, that manufactured machine gun, then offered it for sale. And basically, I don't know that they went back to his other clients and did anything, but there was nothing in the opinion that talks about that occurring.
Further questions for Mr. Luckupt from members of the committee? Senator Coghill?
No questions. I think, Mr. Chairman, if I might, appreciated the citations that helped me understand, and I appreciate the sponsor's push, because it really, if we're going to tell the citizens that we're doing this, we're going to have to let them know very clearly that it is a challenge to the federal government that breaches two major things, that is the U.S. Constitution protection under the Second Amendment and the state's rights constitutional authority. And the question is going to be, in this, it looks to me like, whether the Commerce Clause trumps those. And whoever chooses to wander out into this world, that's got to be the recognition, mm-hmm. as far as I can see.
Let me just ask, have you kept abreast of the litigation? I think it's in the state of Montana there, and can you give us an update on it?
I don't really have an update. The district court hasn't ruled in that, as far as I know, or at least last time I checked here a couple weeks ago. They've exchanged briefs.
Give us a little background. Montana passed a similar bill to this one.
Right, and Tennessee has also, and there's a few other states with current laws. Some gun owners or a wildlife group filed suit for seeking a declaratory judgment in U.S. District Court in Montana, and the federal government has responded to that, and I think it's currently in that stage of waiting a resolution or scheduling of arguments or whatever else. I theoretically, there could be some discovery going on in the case, too, and that's where it's sitting right now. That's the only case I know of. There was some talk of one occurring in Tennessee, but I haven't found one yet occurring down there.
And I'll just note that the bill packet contains a letter to Montana federal firearms licensees, Tennessee federal firearms licensees, regarding their need to continue to obey federal law, in essence, despite the passage of a bill similar to this one. Anything else from you, Mr. Luckupt? Any closing comments? Thank you.
Nope.
Thank you. We do have online Sue McLean from the Department of Law, but I understand you're here to answer questions. Is that right, Sue?
I'm here to answer questions. Good afternoon, Senator French.
Any questions from the committee for Sue McLean from the Department of Law? Don't hear or see any. Thanks for making yourself available. If you stay on the line, we're now going to turn to Gary Marbut of the Montana Shooting Sports Association. Mr. Marbut, can you hear my voice?
Yes, I can.
Welcome to the committee. Please put yourself on the record, state your name and affiliation, if any, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, I'm Gary Marbut, M-A-R-B-U-T. I reside in Missoula, Montana, although you might care to think of me as an honorary Alaskan because I lived in Fairbanks during all of the 1970s. I am the president of the Montana Shooting Sports Association, and I conceived and wrote the original Firearms Freedom Act passed in Montana as the Montana Firearms Freedom Act, which was passed by the 2009 session of the Montana Legislature and signed by our governor. As I think you're figuring out the purpose of the Firearms Freedom Act is to set up a challenge to federal Commerce Clause of authority. I think we all know that the federal government regulates probably far more than we would like to have regulated under the guise of regulating commerce among the states, an authority that was expanded a lot during the New Deal era and all the programs that FDR wanted to get working at that time. I'll talk in a moment about the Raich case and the Stewart case. But I want to be clear that the subject of the Firearms Freedom Act is states' rights and a challenge to federal Commerce Clause authority. Firearms are the vehicle for the challenge. And when people have asked me when I wrote this bill, why did I write it about firearms? Why didn't I write it about something else? And the answer is because we're the gun group. We do gun bills. And guns are probably as popular, firearms as popular as here in Montana as they are in Alaska. So we do admit that there's a lot of precedent out there that doesn't bode well for our legal challenge, and I'll tell you about that in a moment. But I want to declare that the purpose of the Firearms Freedom Act is to challenge the status quo, not to conform to the status quo. And our goal is to get all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and persuade them to overturn a lot of precedent surrounding the Commerce Clause. It has turned out to be a very popular idea. It's been introduced, it's been passed in Montana and Tennessee, as you've heard, and clones of our original Montana bill have been introduced in 22 other states, and there are some states very close to enactment. It's gone to the governor in Utah. It's passed one body in Arizona and South Dakota and South Carolina and other states I'm losing track of. In any case, our Montana Firearms Freedom Act became effective here in Montana on October 1st of 2009, and we filed our lawsuit on that date, and that's what we had promised to do, was to get the issue into court. Meanwhile, I've heard your discussion about concern about people in Alaska who might get crosswise with federal law, and we have advised all Montanans in every news release we put out, which has been well covered by the media, that people should not try and make these Montana-made items until we can validate the principles of the Montana Firearms Freedom Act in court. So that message has gone out pretty well in Montana. And again, what we're looking for is a legal exercise to validate the principles and to change the existing precedent in the Commerce Clause area. Now, the question may be, how can we do that? Well, I don't want to go into a long history lesson about Commerce Clause for you, but I want to cite a couple of recent precedents. In D.C. v. Heller, Justice Scalia wrote that opinion about the right to bear arms, and his final comment in that opinion was, "What is not debatable is that it is not the rule of this court to pronounce the Second Amendment extinct." Okay, well, we say it's also not the role of the Supreme Court to pronounce the Tenth Amendment extinct. The Supreme Court does overturn a lot of precedent, and Chief Justice Roberts just commented on that about 2 weeks ago in the free speech case, Citizens United versus the FEC. And he talked about when the court could or should overturn precedent, and if I may, I'd like to read you a short quote about what he said in that decision. He said, "If adherence to precedent actually impedes the stable and orderly adjudication of future cases, its stare decisis effect is also diminished. This could happen in a number of circumstances, such as when the precedent's validity is so hotly contested that it cannot reliably function as a basis for decisions in future cases, when its rationale threatens to upend our settled jurisprudence in related areas of law, and when the precedent's underlying reasoning has become so discredited that the court cannot keep the precedent alive without jury-rigging new and different justifications to shore up the original mistake." Now, that's where I think we are with the Commerce Clause, and especially in the Raich case. If you've read the Raich case, you will see that what the Supreme Court said is that the marijuana grown and distributed for medicinal purposes in California was indistinguishable from marijuana transported illegally across the state line. And they went on to say that the marijuana distributed under the California Medical Marijuana Act actually affected, theoretically, marijuana in an illegal substance that really didn't have any proper marketplace. That gives you an idea of how far the interpretation of Commerce Clause authority has gone, and gets us back to Chief Justice Roberts' comment about jury rigging new and different justifications to shore up the original mistake. That's where I think that we are. A lot of states are concerned about this. There's a Tenth Amendment wave sweeping America, and a lot of states are beginning to stand up and assert more sovereignty, which, frankly, I think is very proper. The Firearms Freedom Act is part of that, and we certainly think it's a healthy exercise in democracy to take this to the courts and try and persuade the courts that they need, the Supreme Court needs to do something about this bad law that started generally in the 1940s with the New Deal era. We also have some new and fresh arguments to make, we will make in this litigation, that have never been made before, as far as I know, in contests about the Commerce Clause. One, for example, is that the Commerce Clause was amended, as was the Supremacy Clause and the Necessary and Proper Clause. They were all amended by the Tenth Amendment. And those of you who are attorneys will remember that it's a bedrock principle of jurisprudence that if there is a conflict between two provisions of a co-equal body of law, the most recently must be given preference as the most recent expression of the enacting authority. Without that principle, law could not be amended or repealed. So that argument has never been made about the Commerce Clause before, and that's one of the fresh arguments that I think can change the course from the precedence of the Raich decision and decisions before it. So that's probably more talking than I have to do. I do think that it's a good, healthy exercise, and I would urge you to approve House Bill 186, and I'd certainly be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Marbut. That was a good argument. Let me ask you this, and I should know this off the top of my head, but maybe you can just make a record for us. Raich was decided in 2005. Personality changes? Who's different now in the Supreme Court in 2010 than there was in 2005?
I think for the majority that we would need to see a change in Commerce Clause law, there hasn't been any significant change. But we are hoping that this time around Scalia will be with us, especially because of his comments in the Heller case. And we want to challenge him to say, you said that it's not the role of the court to pronounce the Second Amendment extinct. Well, we're here with the Tenth Amendment, and we want you to say the same thing about that. Then, as the court watchers will know, there are four who are likely to vote for us and four who are likely to vote against us, which leaves Justice Kennedy in the middle as the usual swing vote. And but one thing unique that the court watchers say about Justice Kennedy is that he is the one who is most interested in public opinion. And with that, we have this emerging consensus of two states having passed the Firearms Freedom Act and 22 others introduced, and another maybe as many as half dozen likely to come online in the near future with their own versions of the same thing. That's going to be very persuasive to the Supreme Court, especially to Justice Kennedy, I believe.
But just so I'm clear, which side did he come down on in Raich? Was he dissenting or was he with the majority?
He was with the majority. Scalia was with the majority then. But I think we have new rationale which will put him in a little different position.
Very good. Other questions for Mr. Marbut from members of the committee? I don't see any. Thank you, sir, for making time to testify with us this afternoon.
You're welcome.
We do have some folks signed up online. I had closed public testimony, but we have a few minutes. There's no reason not to hear from members of the public if they're interested in testifying. Let's go to the TOC, LIO. And see if Mr. Floyd, it's not clear if the folks there are listening or wanting to testify, but I'll turn to you and ask you if you're interested in testifying and begin with James Floyd.
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Sure can, sir. Thanks so much. State your name and affiliation for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Hi, my name is James Floyd, and I just represent myself. I've been listening in, and I just have a question, really. In light of the BATF letters that came out last year, shortly after a lot of these states actually passed their Freedom Acts. I understand that the BATF letters the way it was written, it applies to federal firearms licensees, but it doesn't mention that if you're not a federal firearm licensee. I'm wondering if anybody had any thoughts or had heard of the idea of sort of a state firearms licensee vice a federal firearms licensee. And with that, I'll just stop here and listen in. Thank you very much.
Mr. Floyd, thank you. I don't know that I can provide shed any light on your question. I don't know whether Mr. Marbot wants to take a swing at it or not. Mr. Marbot, did you hear the question?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to.
Please go ahead.
As your caller pointed out, the letters that were addressed to Montana licensees and Tennessee licensees were addressed only to those individuals. And we've assumed all along that people who have federal firearms licenses would not be players in the state-made guns game because they require national markets and shipping across state lines for their business models. So we've assumed all along that it would be the mom-and-pop machine shops and the gun tinkerers who would make these state-made items if we can validate the principles of the Firearms Freedom Act in court.
Thank you. Good answer. Did that answer your question, Mr. Floyd?
Yes, sir. That gives some ideas to it. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Anyone else there at the TOC-LIO? I've got a few people signed up, but it wasn't clear from the sign-up sheet whether you wanted to testify or not, but I don't want to turn you aside if you're there and you'd like to give the committee a few minutes of your thinking on this bill. Just go ahead and step up to the microphone, give us your name and affiliation, and go ahead.
Nope, TOC has no more testifiers.
Very good. Thanks so much. Thanks for your help there. We do have also online from Kenai Scott Hammond. He has testified earlier. However, we do have a few minutes. Mr. Hammond, if you'd like to chime in again after having heard the legal arguments, go ahead. We'd be happy to hear from you.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry to say, unfortunately, there was two hearings scheduled at 1:30 today, and I've been in another room. But I did want to reiterate that I'm very supportive of this bill. I think it's very important for the state of Alaska to step up and join Montana. I'm sure other states are going to do this. Let the federal government know that we are very serious about this, and it's time for us to assert our rights under the Constitution. And I very much support it again. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Hammond. And I guess I just pose the question is to, or maybe this is for the bill's sponsor, who I notice is taken off. But I guess it may be more of a philosophical question. I know we've got staff here if you'd like to come forward. And I guess the question is since the issue is trying to get the question, I mean, it sounds like from Mr. Marbot, they understand that no one should take action under this state law, should it pass, sua sponte. They should wait until the issue's been settled by the Supreme Court so no one goes to jail for doing something under federal law that they thought they were allowed to do under state law. That'd be bad. No one wants to see that happen. Given that challenge is taking place in Montana, I guess I sort of wonder what the, why should Alaska sort of subject even a single one of its citizens to this potential calamity, given that the challenge is going to be completed through the Montana case?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Derek Miller, staff to Representative Kelly. I think some of the stated reasons that to Mr. Marbot maybe have expressed previously would be the same reasons that we would want to join in on that lawsuit and that contention.
It in essence becomes sort of almost an amicus brief, if you will. The bill itself becomes a brief to the Supreme Court saying that the legislature sort of agrees with the thrust
yes,
of the
yes, Mr. Chairman.
I take your point. That's a good well done good point. Any other questions for the
just comment, Mr. Chairman?
Yep.
Thank you. I think you characterize it very well, but I think there are people who would willingly, I think, subject themselves to it. Thinking of it as a patriotic duty. So I think in Alaska there are many that would feel very strong to assert this. So given that opportunity, plus the volume of voice throughout America challenging, I think, whatever the Commerce Clause versus the Second Amendment issues would be. I know in my area, the volume was loud.
Thank you for that, Senator Coghill. Further comments? Hearing and seeing none, we're going to go ahead and hold this bill over. But thank you for everybody for making the time to get in front of the committee today. So that concludes HB 186, and that brings us to a couple of legislative confirmations. Perfect timing. Who wants to go first?
Connor Thomas.
Connor Thomas, welcome to the committee. Nice to see you again, Mr. Thomas, and thank you for your continued willingness to serve in this capacity. Go ahead and introduce yourself to the committee. Tell us what confirmation you seek, and tell us a little bit about why you seek it.
Thank you. Chairman French, members of the committee, my name is Connor Thomas. I am from Nome, Alaska, where I've lived for the last 32 years. I've served on the committee since 1999, and I'm asking to be confirmed for another three-year term on the Select Committee for Legislative Ethics. I consider a public service. It's a public service that I feel like I can do and meet my responsibilities on the committee, as even though I'm a part owner of a small law firm in Nome, but the time commitment is not so great that I can't fulfill my obligations. And I feel like it's a duty, it's a necessary duty that I enjoy for the citizens of the state of Alaska. And we're asking once again that you allow me to continue on. So thank you.
Mr. Thomas, thank you. I've served on the committee with you, so I don't have any questions. I'm perfectly comfortable and happy that you're stepping forward to serve again. I'll turn and ask members of the committee if they have any questions for Mr. Thomas.
Just thank you for your service.
Senator Coghill?
How long, Mr. Connor, have you served now?
1999, I think, was my first.
It's institutional history now.
pretty close.
Mr. Cook's been on longer than I have, so he's.
Any further questions for Mr. Thomas? Thanks for being here. Appreciate
thank you
taking the time to come down and see us face to face. A lot of these folks, a lot of these happen on over the voice wires, but I guess you guys had a meeting here in town.
We do.
Very good. Very good. Mr. Turner, welcome. Put yourself on the record. Tell us what it is you seek, why you seek it.
Yes, thank you, Chair French, members of the committee. Yes, I'm Gary Turner. I live in Soldotna, and I am the director of Kenai Peninsula College. It's a unit of the University of Alaska Anchorage and University of Alaska. I've just now finished my first three-year term on the committee and just gave up my chairmanship to Mr. Thomas, in effect, in just an hour or two. I truly enjoy working on this committee. And as Mr. Thomas said, I consider it a true public service. It's an intriguing public service. Also, you don't really understand what goes on in this committee or what Joyce Anderson does until you become the chair. And then it becomes your second full-time job. So I'm really glad to give it back to Connor. So I really look forward to being reconfirmed if you believe I'm worthy.
Likewise, I served not a full term, but a couple of years with Mr. Turner while he was on the committee. I'm thrilled that you're back to be a continuing member. I really think you grow in the job, you learn a lot. It takes a while to get up to speed, frankly. There are a complex set of rules that attend the ethics laws in the state, and it doesn't just turn on like a light switch. No. It takes a little while.
It does.
Other questions for Mr. Turner from members of the committee? Senator Coghill, looks like you just want to say something.
The temptation to ask... from somebody who's served their first term, and I appreciate the fact that it's been a new perspective. Just from your perspective, coming from kind of the academic world, is probably a little different than, say, coming from the legal world. As you looked into this cadre, any major surprises that just struck you?
Well, I certainly depend upon the three attorneys that are on the committee, but I also think that I, as not being an attorney, bring a different viewpoint and maybe a different view of the world, which I think is healthy.
And Mr. Chairman, I wanted to draw him out on that because I happen to sit on a panel here of attorneys, and I'm not an attorney, and it does bring a different perspective.
I couldn't agree more. Further questions for Mr. Turner? Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
we have the letters. Let me just go ahead and... Right. I'll read the letter. In accordance with AS 246130, the judiciary... Actually, do we need a motion to move them out? Is that how it works? Please. Yep. Senator Wolakowski.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would move that we move the nominations of Gary Turner and Connor Thomas to the full body House and Senate for a final vote.
Any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, I'll just go ahead and read the letter so it's clear. In accordance with AS 246130, the Judiciary Committee reviewed the following and recommends the appointments be forwarded to the Senate floor for consideration. Gary J. Turner, H. Connor Thomas. This does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individuals during any further sessions. Hearing no objection to the motion, the names are moved on. We'll sign the letter, and I wish you all a wonderful afternoon. With that, we're adjourned.